Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host, and we have a great show for you this evening. I met the gentleman that is our guest tonight several years ago, and while I met him, I ran into Alejandro Rojas for the first time, and he'll be coming up with the UFO updates first before our guest. I do want to thank everyone that helps out with the show. And I also want to thank everyone that supports the show, and anyone can do that. That's either on Patreon, or you can go to our website, podcastufo.com. Over there at our website, we have a new blog up again this week. This one's called 911 UFO Part 2. It talks about the Midwestern UFO calls. People were calling into police stations, and it's a really good blog. Check that out. That's by Charles Lear. Peggy helps out with the Facebook page. We have a new story up there every day of the week. So check that out at over at Facebook. And I want to thank you all for listening to the show. You know, just coming up in 2 weeks, it's going to be our 8th year anniversary. I can't even believe it. And I might as well have Alejandro jump in now. Alejandro, how are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Good. When did you, when that was 2013, right? When you and I met at, I believe that's when the we met down in North Carolina.
Yeah, that sounds right. I know Kent will know better.
Yeah.
But it sounds right.
Yeah.
And so that was, I think, one of the best conferences. I mean, you know, we go to a lot of conferences. But I loved it because I thought the lineup was remarkable. Now, Leslie Kane, I know, got to help him with that. But there was, I mean, we got some really important interviews from that, that, you know, are some interviews we weren't able to get anywhere else. Francois, I think his name was. I can't remember the right now, the guy who was running JPON, the UFO program in France at the time.
Yep.
General de Brouwer, who was the guy who investigated the triangles in the 1990s. Those were a couple of big ones. We've interviewed him several times, but the international representative of CEFA-A, Chile's official UFO organization, was there. And a number of other really important people. That was a remarkable conference. And yeah, that's where you and I met, because there weren't many people there. There were, you know, compared to some of the other really large ones, there's quite a few for the space. But you and I were there, and that was a ton of fun getting to know you. And hey, look what happened.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, I remember. I remember trying to pronounce your first name. I had trouble with your name. And yeah,
I think I remember that. We spent some time there trying to.
Training
how to say my name.
That's right. But yeah, there was a lot of great people there. I met Randy Nickerson. I remember that was the first time I met him. And Leslie Kane, of course, and Charles Halt. It was just it was a wonderful time. Really, really fun.
Yep, it was great.
And so, what is going on with you?
With me or UFO news?
I don't know if you want to talk about you. Everyone knows that you were moving last and moving out of your house, and you had to hurry, so you couldn't be there last week. So you're just a busy guy.
Yep, been crazy busy. But it's been a lot of good stuff, exciting stuff. Of course, I didn't have a show this week, as any of my listeners who listen to your show, which is quite a few, will know. So I apologize for that, but I'll have a show up next week. Of course, I'm here with you, and then I'm going to be talking with Lee Spiegel tomorrow on his show, so that will be a lot of fun. Otherwise, I guess a couple new things, and this is kind of funny. I was thinking of this just now, and I would love to hear your thoughts, and I don't know, maybe I talk about this too much, but I'm not the only one talking about this stuff. I was just about to talk about this, you know, one of the few stories that have been out in actually the last week, which is this New York Times article about Tom DeLonge. And it features an interview not just with Tom DeLonge, but also with Luis Elizondo. So this is a big deal. It's New York Times. Tom DeLonge, of course, is the rock star who used to work or play with Blink 182. Now he's touring, actually, right now with his band Angels and Airwaves. And Luis Elizondo used to run the Pentagon program. And I don't know why, and I shouldn't feel this way, and it's kind of, it's bad. It doesn't say much for UFO research. I kind of tweeted about it yesterday, but I almost, for some reason, feel a little self-conscious about saying positive things about Tom and Lou, and I shouldn't feel that way. I mean, there's no reason to feel that way. It's just there's so many haters out there that, you know, I know, and I think it's maybe almost like PTSD. I prepare shell shock. I prepare myself, you know, for this barrage of negativity, you know, just saying something positive about these guys.
Yeah. You know, someone sent me just a tweet or something yesterday that you were a little bit of a battle. And yeah, I get that. I see that happening. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know.
And it's not a, at my end, and this is what I was writing about, you know, people keep saying, you know, as if people are choosing sides or like, you know, everything's about who won this side or that side. And most of us don't feel like we're on a side. I'm not on any side at all. I'm covering news and information. You know, you have this rock star who started this great organization that's getting a lot of news out that's been literally instrumental in getting the Navy. Really, if this wouldn't have happened, the Navy probably wouldn't have come out. They wouldn't have talked about UFOs at all like they have in the last few months. And that's also, you know, Tom DeLonge provided the space. And luckily, you know, things worked out where Lou Elizondo was able to come out from working at the Pentagon and work with Tom and have this space with other professionals to do some of the extraordinary work that they're doing. But what they're doing is really important. And I don't understand why, you know, the hate, especially, you know, why we need to, or some feel that we need to kind of, what feels like to me, just, you know, blindly hate these people and assume that they're up to something negative. And, you know, we've seen this trend. This happened to Bob Bigelow. You know, a billionaire who came into the field. I think it happens with a lot of people who have are prominent or have money. And it's an interesting thing. I'd still like to break that down and try to figure out, you know, what it is. Maybe it's just the innate, you know, kind of skepticism or cynicism of people who are interested in this topic. But I think there's also the silent masses, the many, many people out there who are interested, who listen to our shows, for example, and they want information and they want news. And they don't really have a horse in the race either, except that they're excited to hear more about the topic and more credible information about the topic. And I think to learn more about the topic. And that's what I believe that Tom and Lou are facilitating. And, you know, when you look at this New York Times article, and this is my whole point, it's a great article. It's very good. I think that the answers that Tom and Lou gave were very good. They were grounded. They were careful to say, especially Lou, we don't know what, you know, is going on out there. We just know that there's a phenomena and we're investigating it. Some of the headlines due to this New York Times article are things such as this. This is from Science Alert. Alien research group started by Blink-182 singer says it's found exotic UFO material. And that's a more accurate way to put it. Others have said, you know, they found material from UFOs or they found alien material or some of these other things that just go very much too far, where Lou was very careful to say these are unknown. And hopefully the writer of the headline that I just read understands that UFO means unknown. And in that sense, it's accurate because they, like Lou said, we're following the data and we'll see where the data takes us. But so far, you know, there's reasons for us to think that this material that we have is interesting. So it's a great article, I think, that demonstrates there is serious research going on in this field, that there are credible people who take this mystery seriously, and that there's investigation and research going on to try to figure it all out. And for that reason, and one other thing to note, I think, about this New York Times article, it's not written by the same people who wrote the really groundbreaking article that really broke things open. And in fact, out of those three people who wrote that original article in December 2017, Ralph Blumenthal and Leslie Kane and Helene Cooper, two of those people, Blumenthal and Kane, Kane, of course, who we referred to, helped at this North Carolina conference you guys will be talking about. But they're very familiar with the UFO phenomena and have written about the UFO phenomena. As far as I know, I don't know that this this gentleman who wrote this New York Times article, Derek Bryson Taylor, this new one that just came out, I think it came out like, you know, just like a few couple days ago. He is someone who doesn't, you know, isn't familiar with UFOs and the UFO phenomena. And it's interesting that, you know, he took such a straightforward take on this article to report. And I think that's another important thing that's going on here is that mainstream journalists are feeling more comfortable to do that. I've been hanging out with Brian Bender quite a bit. He writes for Politico. He's a defense and space editor, which is a pretty big deal. This guy hobnobs and hangs out in Washington, D.C. He hobnobs with generals and secretaries of this and secretaries of that. And, you know, all of the main shakers, movers and players, politicians. And, you know, he doesn't really care about the UFO community or what the UFO people want. He's just trying to write stories like this gentleman in the New York Times. And they're finding it, you know, very interesting, all of this credible stuff coming out. Unfortunately, not to put words in Bender's mouth, but he's also struggled, you know, with what the, in fact, that's how we connected, in that we were being lumped together and attacked as people who are promoting to the stars and we're just big fans of theirs and we're doing whatever they say. Brian Bender could really care less. The To the Stars people are very low on the totem pole compared to the people he usually deals with. He just, being someone who writes about defense and space, finds the story very interesting, and he finds all of this credible information very interesting. In my opinion, these journalists are being good journalists and doing their job, which is a little bit different than we've seen in the past. The topic hasn't been taken seriously. So just because journalists are taking these things seriously and they're finding, you know, DeLong and Elizondo to be credible, I don't know why we need to attack these people and assume that they're terrible or bad or anything like that. So, well, I don't know. It's kind of an interesting dynamic we find ourselves in. On the one hand, we have, you know, incredible articles like this New York Times one that just came out that is taking the topic seriously and examining it in a grounded, you know, unbiased way. And then we have the reaction from many in the UFO community, which is just extremely negative, which is counterintuitive.
Well, I think, you know, my sideline take on this whole thing is that, you know, there are a couple of discrepancies when it comes to the forms and, you know, the releasing of the videos and stuff like that. And so I think people are just assuming, you know, here we go again. This is another disinfo. You know, project, and you know, they're. I don't know. They're kind of seeing the whole picture as that this is what must be happening, because you know, not everything's exactly as it should be or claimed to be or something like that. You know, I'm thinking that's kind of what's going on with the whole divide. There's definitely a divide for sure.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm sorry, but those are poor arguments, to be honest. And I think that they're definitely spin by people who, by that negative side. I think there's no doubt you can look at my driver's license probably and point out, hey, what's with this? Why is this way? This, to me, seems like there's some deception going on. I mean, it's, you can find and nitpick any document or anything. I mean, it's the level of, you know, how much of a red flag these different types of items are. And it's not just me. I think I'm covering more of those discrepancies in detail than the mainstream journalism. And that's because, you know, I, like other researchers, are into the details, and we are looking for, you know, red flags. But I think one indicator that these red flags are just not a big deal is when you don't have the New York Times or Politico finding any concern. You know, I asked Brian Bender about these issues and others, and they just don't find them a big deal at all. They see this as par for the course and typical when you're dealing with the government. You know, there's not going to be consistencies across every department, depending on, you know, who filled out what form or what department that form was filled out by. However, the bigger picture is, you know, are these large claims substantiated? And that's what they're looking for. And some of these big claims have been substantiated, of course, by other witnesses, key witnesses, such as Kevin Day with the Nimitz or David Fravor, the pilot with Nimitz, and many others that, you know, you've had many of these witnesses on the show. So that information is corroborated. So then it comes down to some of this other information. And as time has gone on, many of those big points, such as, you know, were these Navy, these videos really released from the Navy? Were these videos really showing what the Navy felt were unidentified, you know, aerial phenomena, UAPs or UFOs? You know, did ATIP, the Pentagon program, really look into UFOs? These were the things people were questioning. All of these things have been verified, substantiated and verified by insiders, not just by independent sources that the journalists have gotten. New York Times had an abundance of independent sources they used when they wrote the original article to vet this information in the first place. Mm-hmm. But since then, we've had many documents come out, mostly from George Knapp, but then substantiated by the government as real, demonstrating all these other aspects were also accurate. So these big, large things have all been, you know, noted as accurate. And the little things are just like I said, they're par for the course. Anybody who's researched government documents in this field, you know, when you see or government documents, especially military documents at all, you can see some that are very well done, but you can see the vast majority that are very sloppy, people cutting corners and not filling out all fields, those sort of things. You know, that happens. So there's human error involved with all of this. And and so, you know, finding the – so those are certainly things to look at and pay attention to, but they're not, you know, big picture, big red flags that should inspire the sort of negativity and hatred that it seems to inspire in a lot of very – using a term from Stan Friedman, very loud, noisy negative out there.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Well, speaking of the Nimitz, you know, witnesses, next week, just to let everyone know, we have Kevin Day and Gary Voris, both witnesses are going to be on the show then. But thank you so much, Alejandro. We went a little bit over time, but that's fine. And thanks so much, and we'll be talking to you next week. I hope your move continues to work out well for you.
Thank you very much.
All right.
And yeah, I'll be in AlienCon this weekend. And I'm actually in Arizona now. But yes, otherwise the move's been going well.
Great. Excellent. All right. I'll talk to you next week.
See ya.
All right. See you later. Okay. Our guest tonight, we have Kent Center. I met him, I think it was 2013 in North Carolina. He is a seasoned, longtime UFO researcher. He was raised in Northern Virginia. He's been involved with MUFON from an early time. And so I'm really excited to have him on. He's a fine gentleman. Welcome to the show, Kent. How are you?
Thank you, Martin. Thanks so much for having me.
Yes, we met. I was very happy to meet you way back. Was it 2013? I keep throwing that number around.
Yeah, it was in June of 2013. It was when we held the conference. We had, like Alejandro said, it was a great list of speakers. I got together with Leslie Kane, and she got Jose Lay from CEFAA in Chile.
Yep.
It was Xavier Paso was who... Alejandro was thinking about. It was Xavier Paso from JPON in France.
Okay.
Had the astrophysicist Jeffrey Bennett he wrote all those Max Goes to Mars books for all the school children, the shuttle astronauts to read them. And I had Dr. Westrom came, and I'm trying to think right now who he had. Colonel Halt and General DeBrower. Leslie spoke. I had Nancy Talbot come from BLT Research about the crop circles. And Dr. Wendt were my main list of speakers. And we tried to get the Iranian General Pafari, oh, I can't remember his last name, but he was coming out of Canada, but they would not give him a visa to come down and speak. So
I
missed out on him.
I remember that. Yes, I remember hearing about that. Well, can you tell?
That was a fantastic conference. It had Dr. Haynes and NARCAP.
That's right.
They did actually, after the seminar, Chile and France did an international agreement of cooperation to study this phenomenon once they met at my conference. And then Dr. Haynes with NARCAP also, his group signed in to that cause. I was kind of proud of that, that came about. So
yeah, it was kind of a historic situation in general, you know, with all those people there. I met so many different people there, actually, now that I think about it. And that was early on for me because my show was only a few years old. So can you tell
Randall?
Randall. Yep.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. He was on my show a couple of weeks ago, and that's how you and I got in touch, right?
Right. Right. Yeah. I've you know, Randall, after the meeting, he wasn't one of our speakers, but he came down there to film and interviewed me. And then during the interview process, based on some experiences I've had, I was always interested in this Charles Hall story out in Nevada. And he wrote the millennial, I can't remember the name of it, but he wrote these books about this contact with these beings out in Nevada off Dogbone Lake. And I can't remember the name of the base. It's right outside of Las Vegas. It's where they do the have the drones. But anyhow, he spoke about these beings up there, these tall whites. And so I was talking to Randall, and I said, well, are you meaning right off Dogbone Lake? Because he was out there and he filmed a sighting. And he said, who's Charles Hall? And he didn't even know who Charles Hall was. And I explained to him, and he said, you want to come up to my room and see this film that I filmed? And so my wife and I went upstairs, and just a remarkable film of these just glowing objects, but they move so fast. His view was like a 27-mile range over the mountains from where Area 51 was all the way down to Dogbone Lake. And these things just zipped across the sky and stopped on a dime and went down into those mountains and then came back up and were flying around. And it just really struck me because MUFON had done an article about a pilot in flying, I think, from St. Louis to San Francisco. And as they got close to that area, they were asked to veer north. There was incoming traffic, so they had to divert around Area 51. And he explained that he had these sightings of these, like 30 of these objects come in. And where Area 51 was, he said it's like this big holographic crosshairs came up. It was like a mile high, and these craft were just zipping in through this crosshairs into the Area 51, you know, one after another, just at incredible speeds. And this kind of looked like what Randall filmed, kind of looked, you know, apparently what this guy pilot had described during one of his flights. But it was really, really interesting. But so much occurred. You know, what happened was I got cancer. I've got the multiple myeloma. And I decided after all my sightings and everything, because I mainly had stayed quiet about it, you know, for just pretty much most of my life. And I wanted to come out with what I knew and things I've heard and what I've experienced. And I wanted my children to understand what my views on it were and to know a little bit more about me. And so I decided to hold this conference, and when I did, so many things occurred. That, for instance, one of my sightings was down in Lumberton with this apparently like a V-shaped craft. But Leslie asked me to interview, and I think I heard Alejandra say you're going to have Lee Spiegel on next week or your next show. Well, she had asked me to interview with Lee Spiegel because he was writing for the Huffington Post. So he asked me what got my interest into it. So I started going back through my sightings that I had. And the one was down in Lumberton. And I started explaining to him about, you know, I was driving down this road and saw sheriff's car, police car, and guys standing out in the field. You know, when I saw this thing, basically was gliding off in the distance. It's like a reddish glow to it. And it was gliding over the treetops going away. So then I took off after this thing, and I couldn't catch it. And he said, he stopped me, and he goes, Ken, he goes, do you know who I am? I said, no. I said, I'm Stanger, the writer from Huffington Post. And that's when Lee explained to me. He organized that UN meeting back in the 60s, I believe, with had Cooper there. And
yeah, late. It was actually 1978, I do believe.
78 yeah. and 70, yeah, okay. Yeah. So he organized that meeting, and then he goes and explains. He says, Ken, I want to tell you something. The guys you saw standing out in the field, that was me.
Huh?
And I said, what? He goes, that was me out in the field. He said, I was investigating for a Jalen and Hynix group, the CUCOs, and he said, he asked me to come down to Lumberton and investigate that sightings that they were having down there at the time.
And oh, yes, here's the man. Right. That's right.
You know, and so, you know, there was family members that I told about my sighting and a couple of my sightings, actually. I did a podcast with Tim Beckling. We talked about this synchronicity, how it's so strange. But all of a sudden, when I held this conference in 2013, my wife, who from 2000 on, I told her all my stories and, you know, my childhood sightings. And so here I meet the guy that was standing out in the field, you know, and she was shocked when she heard that because she remembered me telling the story. And here I got to meet the guy that was standing out in the field of this sighting that I had. And then I don't want to jump around too much. I was trying to take it in order. I had sightings when I was 9 and when I was 14 years old in Northern Virginia. It really startled me. But one of the things about it is my best friend's father was deputy director for FAA. And he was a major in the Air Force, and he flew under Curtis LeMay. And I knew when I saw they had this sighting, I was over to his house, and he's the first person I ever asked anything about UFOs or flying saucers. And I asked him if they were real. And he turned to me, he had a strange look on his face. He turned to me and he explained to me, he says, you know, there was a guy in my outfit once that walked into a hangar and supposedly had one of these crashed flying saucers in that hangar, and he wasn't supposed to see it. And he goes, you know what they did to him? And I said, no. And he goes, they locked him up in a mental hospital for a couple of years. And I was like, why'd they do that? And he says, well, when he gets out and talks, who's going to believe him? And I was, you know, so young at the time, and it terrified me because this was back in when Kennedy was president, and, you know, everybody was John Ho, you know, everybody was all American, and, you know, I couldn't believe the government would do something like that. And then I started thinking in my mind, being a young kid, that if I opened my mouth and said what I saw, they were going to put me away, you know, and that was at such a young age. It was pretty traumatic for me, you know. So I never talked about what I saw. And until, you know, later, like I said, later on in the years when I was married to my wife. And so anyhow, I had that sighting, and then another sighting that I had where I was sleeping out, and I'm by my back porch, and this, I'm going to say craft, it was an orange disc shape, and it had a light coming down, and this light, it was like a cone shape, but it stopped about 3 feet above the ground, and that's what just, it shocked me, because light doesn't stop, you know,
mm-hmm.
And this light just stops about 3 feet above the ground, and I got up and went outside the screen porch into my backyard, and the light was rising back up, and it would just started floating off real quietly. I mean, you could hear a pin drop, And he just started floating above the trees and was floating away. And I just remember running down the street after this thing, trying to get a better view of it. But
wow,
those were two sightings when I was young that I was just, it was just, it really, you know, put the questions in my mind. What are these things? What's going on? But
So you started the North Carolina chapter of MUFON, though, in the 80s at some point. So
right. Well, what happened after the Lumberton sighting is I had a personal sighting in Durham around 84, I would say. It was 84, 85. And this was a craft. I mean, this kind of like the, I would say it was more like the Taconic Parkway, Hudson Valley sightings. This was a craft that came. It had these lights, and this craft was. I had gotten home from work, and I was working two full time jobs, and so I had like an hour in between shifts that I'd come home and eat and change clothes, and I got out of my car coming home after my first shift job, and got out of my car and stood in the driveway. And as I was going to the house, I looked up, and this craft was about a quarter mile off in the distance up in the sky, just standing perfectly still. And I just remember walking to the end of the sidewalk and lining it up against a tree just to see if this thing had any movement at all, these lights, and they didn't. So I got my wife to come out, and she took a look at it, and she immediately turned and ran in the house. I don't know why, but she just took off. And I had been flashing a flashlight at it, just, you know, three long and three shorts, just off and on, trying to signal this thing just to see if I could get any response. And luckily, I had my eyes on it. It did, I guess it's like a light switch. They all turned off, and it was pitch black. Couldn't see anything. Huh. And then I'm going through my mind, you know, why didn't I have a camera? Why didn't I have something, you know? And I was a little frustrated, and I threw the flashlight back into my car and leaned back on the car, and all of a sudden, this craft was above my head. I guess about maybe 50 to 75 feet high, and it was rotating, and it was like I was watching the back end of this thing turning around. It was like a big bar, and of this, it was like a bright fluorescent blue, bluish-white light, and saw this craft, just no sound, and this thing just rotated around and zipped off.
Wow.
So I don't know if you remember, I had this reenacted, and I had a film crew reenact this whole scene and what it looked like for that conference.
I think I remember something about that. Yes. Okay.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So anyhow, that at that moment, you know, right after that, I said I've got to get in touch with somebody that knows what's going on with these things or whatever, and I think it was a book by Margaret Sachs. It was Encyclopedia of UFOs. And I looked up in North Carolina, there was this George Fawcett, who was a longtime researcher, and I gave him a call, and we hooked up and met, and I actually had him come speak to a Kiwanis group, and just to show you how bad I wanted to find out what was going on at that point, I didn't belong to this group, but I paid $500 for him to come up and speak to this group, and I wasn't even a member of this group, and just so I could make this connection and talk, and we hit it off, and we became very close, and that's when his idea was, you know, do we want to start up a MUFON chapter, because apparently up in New Hampshire area and in the Northeast, he had lived up there and had UFO groups, study groups. And so we started the MUFON chapter back in the mid to late 80s. And that's how the MUFON chapter got started. Mm-hmm. But back to the synchronicity, I had a sighting that I was asked to go out and investigate. Actually, it was was a cattle abduction. And I was asked to go interview what happened was the Alamance County Sheriff's Department was calling in the MUFON and asked if somebody could show up there. Well, I thought that was strange. Here's the Sheriff's Department asking for help. Not that I could, you know, there is no degreed person in ufology. So, but I just decided, you know, I'd go out there and talk to them and just investigate this report. And it was remarkable. It was just this old farmer, I guess he was in his probably back then he was in his early 80s, I'd say, and all he cared about was his prize cow. And he was so upset, and he was screaming at the police and the government, and just, you know, he wants his cow back. That's all he kept screaming. So anyhow, I went and filmed this area, and I filmed a location. It was a big open field with it hung around down by the trees. The cow liked to hang by a creek down in the trees. I went down there and filmed. That was the last place he saw this. He said he saw this big light above the trees. And the next morning went out and his cow was gone. Wow. So I went down in those trees and started filming. And the guy I was training to investigate was with me. He pointed out, he said, "Kent, look up." And I looked up, and there was a big hole in the trees, and branches were broken upwards.
Hmm.
And so I filmed this. I had a VHS recorder, and I filmed this because it was up pretty high, about 70 feet up. And I just thought that was the strangest thing. And it wasn't even 3 days later, I'm going to say, they call Men in Black or whatever. But I managed an apartment complex and a mobile home park at the time. And I'm used to police coming in, checking on different residents and so forth and so on. So I keep these files locked up of their records. And I just remember glancing out the window and these guys in black suits coming in and walking towards the door. So I turned to my right and started unlocking the files. And when I go to turn back, the first one that comes through had to bend his head totally over to get in my door.
Wow.
And these two, it was the strangest. I don't think his face was more than probably 2.5-3 inches wide at the bottom. And the whole typical thing, the fedora hats, the big black sunglasses. But this first one that walked in was, I'm going to say, 7 foot tall, easy. And he was almost robotic. He turned with his back. He opened the door and turned with his back and, like, faced across the room. A little, who I call Shorty, walked in. He was, like, the middle guy. And then when the third one came, this one came in, and he was identical. I mean, spit an image of the first guy, another tall one. And he came and got behind me. And it was just the strangest event that happened. I mean, this guy was yelling something. The Shorty was the only one that talked, and he was kept yelling something at me, but I couldn't focus because I wanted to see this tall guy's eyes. And I couldn't see his eyes because he had these glasses on. But one thing I can't stress enough how quick this was. As soon as that thought went in my head, "I want to see your eyes," he dropped his head down, like, to the floor, so, like, I couldn't look up under his lenses. And he just kept his head looking straight down at the floor. And I started thinking, okay, you can read my mind then. Okay, you know, what's going on here? You know, and I'm just focused on this first one. And finally, the short guy spins me around in my chair, and it's like, "You want to see eye?" He rips his glasses off, and he had just the perfect circular eyes. They were completely round and the brightest blue I've ever seen in my life. It was unbelievable. The whole thing just floored me. I didn't know what was going on. It almost seemed like I was losing track of time. It's like everything just came to a standstill.
And what did they want?
He was just screaming at me not to ever go back out there.
Where the cows were? Like, where the cow was?
Yeah.
The farm?
Back to that site. He just kept saying, "You don't go back out there. You understand me?" And he said it three times that I could hear. He said, "You know, you don't go back out there." And I'm like, "I understand. I understand." And then they turned and walked out the door. And then I just sat there, and I wanted to get their license plate, and I couldn't even get out of my chair. And about the time they were pulling out of the property, I was finally able to get up, and I could see they were government plates, but I couldn't read the numbers on them or the letters. And it was just the strangest thing that ever occurred in my life, even stranger than my sightings. It was just, so I went back inside and sat down at my desk and was just, I was, you know, almost at the point I was shaking, and I sat there. And I looked up, and my camera I had left in the kitchen, which is open right off the living room. And I had my camera up on the counter there that separates the kitchen from the living room. And I noticed the compartment was open and the tape was gone.
You mean
and
the
yet
film?
I did not see. Yeah, or I did not see them move around and get it or anything, but it was gone. Huh. And it just, you know, I had to go to the next time we had our meeting. They asked me to talk about it. I said it was just, I don't know, it was nothing to it, and I just blew it off. And it just always stuck in my head. And that was one thing when I heard about these Charles Hall and these tall white signs. It's the first thing I could think of was just this, these tall, you know, bean type things. But, well, cutting back, I happened to be at a, Timothy Good was giving a talk in Raleigh, North Carolina that night that I got the call from MUFON. And I couldn't remember the date, so I got in touch with Timothy Good and got the exact date when he did his talk. So the next day I knew was when I went out to the site. And so I was able to put down the dates exactly when this occurred. And here's where it gets really crazy. Through all of this, I had moved. I got away from MUFON. I moved with my jobs up to New Jersey and Pennsylvania. And when I got sick with this cancer, we moved back. We had just moved back down in January of 2013, and I decided to give this, do this conference and do this whole thing. And I told my wife, you know, my wife's heard these stories, you know, that I've told her. And when she was shocked about the Lee Spiegel, because she remembers me telling her, you know, the guys in the field. So I was telling her about, you know, I said, you know, I really need to get down to the Alamance County Sheriff's Department and check to see if any of the other deputy sheriffs had any kind of, you know, encounter by the MIBs or if anybody else went through that. Because I never even gave them my address or anything. I don't know how this they even showed up at where I worked. And I remember George Fawcett had a similar thing happen to him that he told me about, where they showed up at his daughter's college dorm. He was up in Chicago speaking, and they kind of got him outside after his talk. And this car, this one of these MIBs in the car asked him to get in the car and start talking to him, and told him he needed to be quiet and stop talking, giving presentations about this stuff. He didn't know what he's talking about. And he was warned, you know, you need to stop doing this. And he still went out and spoke a couple of times. Well, when he did, his daughter had called him that one of these guys was in her room. And she knew nothing about the MIBs or anything that George had gone through. He never said a word to his daughter, anything about, you know, what had happened. And she said, there was this guy in my room. And he kept telling me to make sure you stop talking about these UFOs.
What? Pardon me. What do you mean in her room? Not her bedroom.
In her dorm room.
He actually went in the dorm room?
He was in her dorm room, yeah.
Jeez.
And I remember George telling me this, you know, because I was thinking, how did these, you know, whoever they are, how did these MIBs find out where I worked or where I lived? I never even, they just knew my name is Kent at the Sheriff's Department, and I was with MUFON. And I don't know how it all went down. They end up showing at my job, but that occurred. Well, to make a long story short, as the synchronicity in this, when I got down in 2013, I was talking to my wife. I said, you know, I need to go back down to the Sheriff's Department, have some pull records. I'd like to talk to some of those sheriffs. There were three sheriffs that were out in the field that day, and including the one that drove us to the site. And said, I'd like to get in touch with them. And I said, I just, you know, what am I going to say? You know, because I was like, you're going to think I'm some kind of kook. And she goes, well, why don't you call your friend Wayne? Well, Wayne grew up with me in Washington, D.C. He lived on the street behind me in when we grew up. And he moved down to Burlington, North Carolina, which is right next to Graham, which is where this whole Alamance County thing. And he was with the force for 20 years, became a detective, and the whole deal. And I said, honey, I haven't spoken to Wayne in years, and I don't want him thinking I'm some kook with UFOs and stuff like that. And she goes, you know what? She goes, that's your quickest in, and that's your best way in. She said, call him over, invite him over, and, you know, ask him if he can give you a hand. So I said, okay, you know, I'll call him. So I gave him a call. He came over. We talked about old times and stuff. And then I said, look, Wayne, I said, I got a favor to ask you. And my wife, she'll sit here and attest to this. I said, Wayne, I said, you know, ever since I was little, I've been interested in UFOs. And he stopped me right there, and he goes, oh, I know. He says, can't you remember when we were out sleeping out back on the screen porch, and there was that big rectangular UFO that came over? He goes, you remember that? And I'm like, number one, to this day, I have no knowledge of Wayne spending the night and us looking at a rectangular UFO. None whatsoever. And there was no way you could mistake rectangular UFO with an orange disc. And I was quite clear what I saw. And but the fact that he said that, it just, I looked at Patty and she looked at me and she was like, what in the world? And I said, Wayne, what are you talking about? And he goes, my God, Kent, don't you remember that thing that sat over the backyard? He said it was perfect rectangle, sat there over the backyard. I said, you mean the big orange disc? And he goes, no, it was perfectly rectangular. Now, this happened back in the mid-60s, so, you know, I don't even think there was talk of rectangular UFOs back then or anything. So it just, that really shocked me. Here's a friend of mine, you know, it's another, he's a policeman, he's totally sane, you know, been a detective all his life. Mm-hmm. And he mentions this, and I was like, my God. And then it wasn't, I guess, I think it was in 2015, when I was nine, I had that sighting that I told everybody about, and I'm on record, you know, even right before the conference, I did an interview. And in 2015, Norm Gagnon with MUFON Virginia, here's an article on the MUFON Journal about a sighting at the same time that occurred when my sighting occurred. It was a quarter of a mile from my house. It was in Vienna, Virginia. And that's a quarter of a mile from my house in Falls Church. It happened, occurred at the same time, except this kid had saw beings and went through like an abduction thing. But here's this article that comes up 2 years after the conference. And it's, I called Norman, and that's when I had the conference in 2016. I invited Norman and Ben and Tony from MUFON Virginia to come down to our conference. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I spoke with him about my sighting that he had, you know, and investigated, and told him about, you know, my sighting that I had had, that, and showed him, you know, where I had said this years ago. And that occurred just about a quarter of a mile from my house. As a matter of fact, where his sighting was right real close by my elementary school. So,
you know, there's you think about it, there's not a lot of people that have as many sightings as you do. You know, I mean,
no,
most people go through.
And the thing, and, you know, and I sit there, and that's one thing that bothers me. I've had all these sightings, but it's, you know, I say, well, number one, how does people look at that? Well, at this point in my life, I don't care because of my cancer.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm after the truth of what's happened, you know? And there's actually been a couple more incidents that's happened. But
there are people, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. I will say there are people that this does seem to happen to that have, you know, a number of sightings. You know, Ray Stanford, for one, you know, UFO researcher. He's had a ton of sightings, and there are a number of people. And I think it's not just the fact that, you know, because once you have one sighting, you know, I don't know about you, but I'm always looking around, looking up. I'm in an airplane. I instinctively look out, you know, over the wings and look out in the sky. And I wouldn't have done that before, you know, so the
awareness is part of it. At such an early age, I started watching the skies at nighttime. Like, for instance, a couple of these sightings I never would have seen had I not looked up, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's when you think about it, to probably most people, it sounds like a lot of sightings, but I can count them on both my hands. I've had about 10 sightings in my life now. I turned 66, so that's 10 nights out of all those nights of your life.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like it happens that often, but it's the situations that, you know, I tell you what's puzzled me is one of our family friends, who's a friend of my dad's, worked in the Pentagon, and he was with the photo reconnaissance lab at the Pentagon, and he was a jokester. He would always crack jokes at you and make fun of you, and he was very strict with his children. It kind of scared all the neighborhood kids because he was so strict. But there was a Look magazine that I still have that came out that did a special on flying saucers back in 66 or 67. And I remember talking to my mom into getting this magazine. I ran out in the screen porch and was showing it to my dad, and which immediately he got abusive. He was just making fun of me so bad. And between him and another neighbor and Jack, I didn't even want to look up and look at Jack. He was sitting in the corner in a chair, and I knew he was just going to just have a heyday with me. And when I looked at him, he was sitting down with his head looking at the floor, and he was grabbing his hands, clenching his hands like in a fist together, and he was just shaking his head no. And it struck me really funny. I mean, he was really upset that they were teasing me like that. Mm-hmm. And that stood out in my mind. I was like, so later in life, my parents divorced, and my mom had remarried, and this guy who I'm just to say his first name was Jack. Him and his wife came down to my mom's reception down in North Carolina. And at that time I was working retail as a manager of jewelry stores, and I had to just, I only could get away long enough to come to my mom's reception, and then I had to get back to work. So I never even saw Jack standing there, and I ran out the door, and I was getting ready to jog to my car, and Jack stood up outside on the front and yelled my name out, and I turned and ran back to him and said, "How you doing, Jack? I'm sorry I didn't see you standing there." And he goes, "Hey, you still reading those UFO books?" And I said, "Well, yeah, I've got a few I'm collecting." And he goes, "You need to come up and visit me. Lake Gasson, I've retired. I'm living at Lake Gasson. You need to come up and we'll go fishing and talk." And I just blew it off. I said, "Sure, you know, we'll get together, you know, and on about my merry way." And then it wasn't until 2009 that I started asking my mom questions about Jack and Margaret, you know, and because I knew he worked at the Pentagon. And come to find out, Jack was in Roswell. He was there under Colonel Blanchard back in 47.
Wow.
He was everywhere Blanchard went, Jack went, with the exception. Jack went to Wright-Patterson. He worked at Wright-Patterson in photo reconnaissance. He ran the photo reconnaissance lab there. And then Jack followed him all the way up. He's with the Defense Intelligence Agency when they first started it off Columbia Pike, and that was before it moved to the Pentagon. And then Jack went to the Pentagon when they moved, and he worked under Blanchard. So I had a short meeting with Jack and asked him a ton of questions, which he had remarried, and he felt quite uncomfortable answering my questions.
I'm sorry, I'm going to have to do this, though.
Go ahead.
We have to go into our break, and when we come back, I will we'll pick it up with your conversation with Jack.
Okay, will do.
All right. So everyone hang in there. We'll be right back right after these messages. All right, everyone, welcome back. This is Martin Willis. My guest is Kent Center. And we are talking just before we went into break. Kent was talking about Jack, who worked at the Pentagon, and sitting down and conversation. Go ahead.
He had just gotten he had gotten remarried because his wife passed away of cancer. And turns out that the woman he remembered remarried, they were family friends. And his best friend that worked with him at the Pentagon, that was his wife. And Jack and his wife used to play bridge with this couple. So it just seemed he was very uncomfortable talking around her. But I did get, you know, a few questions answered. You know, one I asked about this Colonel Blanchard. And he says, yeah, Blanchard loved to come in my office and look at my pictures every day. And I wanted to invite him down to that conference, but he passed away right before that. And I've had a couple of very bad timing issues. When I had that conference in 2013, I kept receiving these calls from this gentleman that was in a nursing home in Greensboro there where we had the meeting, and he wanted me to come see him. And you know how busy I did that conference all by myself as far as the organization, everything. And
that's a lot of work.
Just, so much work. And I just didn't have time to get to him and never heard another thing back from him. And I'll be darned that in 2016, when I held that next conference with Travis Walton and Tom Reed and Nick Redfern, he called the hotel where we were having the conference and asked me to please come by and see him. And so I came by to see him, and I took a friend who I was going to interview him, because what he told me was he worked for the FBI in his past, and he had something he had with it that wanted to tell me. And I'm like, well, I'll definitely be there. Is it all right if I bring somebody to do an interview? You might want to take some pictures, do some filming, because and he said, no, come on by. So my wife and my friend that did the filming, we show up at his nursing home, and he is so shook up when he's talking to me, and he tells me about this. What occurred was he started out as a field agent in Las Vegas. He lived right outside of Las Vegas, and his other field agent he was friends with lived in Las Vegas, and asked him to come over that weekend, spend the weekend with him, and they'd, you know, go down to casinos or whatever. And as he got to his friend's house, his friend was running out the door and saying, you want to come with me? I got a call. And he goes, no, I'll just wait till you get back. And I'm not sure if that's true or not, that he was going to wait, because he was so shook up as he was talking about this. But what happened was, his friend, he said, got a call, and apparently one of these craft had landed, a UFO had landed, and there were beings outside the craft running around, and it was right off a highway. And they were just running around this craft and shook the guy up terribly, he said. And I'm sitting here looking at him as if he's the one that, just the way he was acting, I'm like, you know, and this guy was in his, I would say he's in his 90s, and I started trying to find out the dates, you know, and asked him if he could remember anything, you know, who was playing at the casinos and what was on TV at the time, and just trying to narrow it down. It was in late 40s, early 50s, and he said he'd try to remember the date, and his name was Howard Richardson was this gentleman's name, and the other agent was named Leandris. And all of a sudden I look up and he's asleep. So I told his nurse, I said, you know, we'll tell him, we'll come back and I'll call him, we'll come back and set up, because I really want to get this on film and let some literature and stuff. And I called him back and he didn't answer his phone. I kept calling and calling. This went on for like 3 weeks, and I told Patty, I said, I think he's pulling the number that he thinks I pull on him, where I never called him back. And Patty just looked at me and she said, Ken, I hate to say this, but why don't you look up in the obituaries? And when I pulled up the obituaries, he had passed away like 10 days after we were there.
Oh,
And it just, it just floored me. And, but when I read his obituary, he actually worked his way all the way up to where he was in charge of all the special agents in Washington, based out of Washington, D.C. So he worked in the headquarters of Washington, D.C., and in charge of the field agents. So, you know, this guy's no kook. You know, this guy's got some credibility to his name. And and to hear that, you know, here's another story, you know, that I recorded. I want to go down that this occurred, you know. So
right
now I'm trying to go through all the Blue Book files of any of this FBI agents that might have had sightings or reported, you know, to investigate a sighting out in the Vegas area, try to track it down. I didn't have any information on his on Leandris, his birth date or death date, and couldn't file a Freedom Information Act on him. But it was just remarkable.
You're working on cases in Las Vegas? Is that what you're saying?
I'm studying anything. All the people that, from this area that live around this area that call in to me, for instance, like the school sighting in Whitsitt here, it's about a half a mile from my house, and it made international news. It's actually listed in that book that Preston Dennett just came out with, Schoolyard UFO Encounters.
I have not heard that, that he came out with that book.
He we've been talking, he communicated with me, he's been on your show before.
Yes,
But it's a great book, and he's listed the Whitsitt. But I did about a half an hour documentary on that case, and I've actually gotten to know Dr. Lambert, the principal. Interviewed him, got his whole record on video.
Can you tell us about that particular case, please?
Yeah, it's there were these craft that were sighted. Dr. Lambeth, a kid came running to school close to the end of the day and said that there were these flying saucers up in the sky. And so he went outside, and all the kids went running out after him. And Dr. Lambeth looked, it was straight above the school, probably about 100 to 200 feet up, and he said they were these just round, circular, shiny objects, like ball bearings up in the sky. And he remembers that they were in formation, like the numbers on a dynamo, like, you know, the six, how they lined up like that. But he said it was possibly, there was eight of them lined up like that. And then all of a sudden, one after another would just zip away and take off until they were totally gone. But as they were leaving, this whole neighborhood got filled with angel hair who had fallen. It was hanging from the electric lines, the neighbor's clotheslines. It was out in the streets. It was everywhere. And as a matter of fact, one kid picked it up and put it in his mouth and tasted it, and he said it was really salty tasting. And which was kind of scary, because there were traits, some of that was radioactive in one of the cases that the angel hair tested positive for radiation. But so he kept this part of this angel hair he had sitting in his desk, and which happened to conveniently disappear. But he sent samples off to Burlington Industries, which they couldn't tell what it was. But it was just a phenomenal case that occurred. That it's to the day, 1 year earlier to the day, was that sighting in Italy over a soccer stadium on the exact date, October 27th, 1954. This angel hair, during a game with like over 10,000 spectators, these UFOs came flying around and dropping angel hair over the stadium. And this occurred exactly 1 year later.
Wow, there is another case. I remember seeing a woman had a sighting in her backyard, and her tree was full. Of like a substance like that. I can't remember the particular case, but you know,
I just remember the soccer players when they did a reunion recently. They were so upset at that. I think it was on the Smithsonian show, or whatever, with that research where they claim it to be ballooning spiders, because these craft are flying. I mean, they're not floating with the air. They're actually, you know, it's as if they're being intelligently controlled and flying at speeds that, you know, they can stop on a dime and then take off at thousands of miles an hour. And this is what Dr. Lambeth, you know, one of his favorite sayings after that sighting, he said, was there's the Old Testament and the Bible and the New Testament. He thinks there ought to be another testament made now. So, and wow, this is coming from a highly religious man. But Dr. Lambeth has a remarkable background. He got an award from the Kennedys for working with autistic children. He was one of the first teachers to ever do that. And the Kennedys, being big into the mental illness, being in their family, everything, they gave him a grant to further his education where he got his doctor's degree. He was a navigator in World War II during, I think he was flying out of it from India into China, doing the battle runs from India to China. But he had to correct the Army Air Corps maps because it would have him running into the Himalayan mountains. And this guy's just a phenomenal person and just as brilliant today as he was 30 or 40 years ago. He just made me feel silly. He really did. His intelligence, he just he humbled you. But anyhow, so I was so happy to get that on film and record this, and did a DVD on him, and just this I suggest anybody interested in these schoolyard sightings. When we talked like Randall, I've sent Randall so many of our conference DVDs to try to get some, you know, donations to help with his movie. That's just a phenomenal case, you know. I just
that's I think one of the all-time, you know, most documented. Well,
the incident at Exeter always stood out in my mind when I was young because it was the first time that I saw where policemen were involved in a sighting. It didn't make me feel so, you know, like I was going crazy, you know, from what I saw.
That's not too. That's not really that far away from where I. Well, actually, where I grew up.
I really hope to make a trip up there someday because it's one of my favorite. That is one of my favorite cases. You know, but I just research. Spend most of my time researching the history and the historical to see where we've, you know, what started this. You know, as far as our technology and how we become involved, and you know, like in the 40s is when it really started up. You know, I mean, they've been around forever, these sightings and so forth and so on, but how they say, you know, is this our craft or their craft, or, you know, these unknowns. I know for a fact, just listen to all these government people and people that have been in the know, there is something out there flying around, and I'm glad that, you know, like with these Navy release video releases and this, at least this is coming out, at least that's changing.
Yes.
You know, at least where the government's starting to say it, but the, you know, the whole political atmosphere of this world right now is like, it's totally so insane. I don't even know how even that can hold something as historical as this. You know, is there life out there? You know, I'm wondering how important it is that to people anymore, you know.
Well, I still think it's, you know, I mean, as a lot of people say, it's, you know, the most important question that'll ever be answered. But, you know, I do know what you're talking about. I know what you're talking about, the news cycles out there. But still, one of the things I think about is, you know, okay, this what they call the modern UFO era, you didn't really hear a lot about anything going on prior to 47, but there are cases. Oh, there's a number of cases.
Oh, tons of cases. I've got stuff back from the 1800s, you know, that...
In your area or in
general? No, mainly out west and around Texas, you know, the airship sightings. There's a lot out west that... I mean, I don't have it right in front of me now, but there's been a lot out west. I think that was the whole premise to that Cowboys and Aliens movie, was just some of these cases.
Well,
they
then,
go back into the 1850s.
Yeah, then in Britain, you know, they had sightings, you know, way back in the 19th century. And earlier, I know Jacques Vallée did a book on historic UFOs. That's something I haven't bought.
Yeah, it's called Wonders of the Sky.
Yeah, that's
Wonders in the Sky, Jacques Vallée and Chris Aubeck. It was an excellent book.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
There's a lot of that in it.
Yeah. I like the historic sightings. And another thing, you know, Dave Marler kind of uncovered that triangle UFOs are not something new. You know, they've been around. not just your sighting, but, you know, I mean, so back to your area in general, would you consider it a hot spot? It seems like there's a lot going on there.
I think it has been a hot spot, I guess you would say. But I think if you find out, if people were to dig, every place could come up with numerous sightings. You're in a real big hot spot up there. As a matter of fact, that Exeter case, not, you know, people talk about that incident in Exeter. It was actually that whole area for like almost a year went through 1,000 sightings, and actually even one landing in the backyard, almost downtown. The Exeter was flooded with sightings during that time in the 60s, 65.
Yeah, I remember. I remember the wave, what they called.
And it just lasted for quite a while. And it wasn't just that one. That one sighting made news because of the police, but. That had numerous sightings, but that area up in there, northeast, United States. I just think it. The more you dig, the more you find. You know, I think UFO sightings are common everywhere.
I think
you just don't hear about it. You know,
there's a lot of military bases up in the northeast too, and I think seems to be some type of connection to that.
Actually, back at that time, there was that Air Force base right there. It was a SAT base, actually. What was it, Portsmouth?
Pease Air Force Base.
Pease Air Force Base, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, that was...
Now, I lived on a hilltop across from the river, our family home when I was growing up, where you could see the whole Pease Air Force Base, not the whole runway, but a part of the runway.
Wow.
So my sisters and I used to watch planes land and take off. And one day we sat and watched something floating. I don't want to say it was a UFO. It was probably a weather balloon, but we watched it for like an hour. But I do remember that was all during the UFO wave. So we were, you know, looking around at that point.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Oh, man. I'd love to have been up there at that time. I don't know why I have such a... It's almost like I want to run to these things, but just interested in it.
Now, when you had any of these sightings, did you ever remember being afraid at all, or was it just curiosity?
No, not afraid whatsoever. I actually felt sad. You know, some of these sightings, they flew away. I felt sad. I actually had a sighting when I was like 4 and a half, and I just felt very sad when they left. I had a big loving of nature. I would bring animals in my house, drove my mother crazy. collecting frogs and brought in snakes.
Oh, yeah,
and everything.
I did all that.
And they kept trying to say, well, why are you doing? And I got to save them all. You know, I was trying to save all these animals.
Yeah.
But, if my battery dies out, if you could call me right back.
Yeah, it sounds like you're having a little bit of a cut. So, you know, with that being said, we're going to we can go into break if you'd like. And
if you can call me back, I'll pick up the other charge phone.
All right. Okay. So,
okay.
Bill, we're going to go into break right now for a couple of minutes. And this is Martin Willis. Hang in, everyone. We'll be right back.
Okay.
All right, everyone, welcome back. Yeah, we had a dead phone on Kent's end. He's all set now. So, Kent, we were talking about UFO waves. I do want to say that we're going to open up the lines in a couple of minutes here, about 5 minutes or so we'll open those lines. But that's kind of funny that you were kind of envious about the Northeast and all the sightings.
Yeah.
You know, there are places, you know, we were talking about cattle mutilations earlier, and, you know, my friend Chris O'Brien wrote a great book about that, but also he was in that area out in Colorado, which is the San Luis Valley. That's just such a hot spot. Have you ever tried to figure out what is a hot spot, why they exist? And
well, basically, that's what I'm pulling together so many cases, just going through. That's all I do. I've got about 500 files that I'm just going through all the literature, all the books, and just writing down all these cases and the ones that stand out to me. You know, like I say, major cases, like the Phoenix Lights was a major case. The Stevensville was a major case. This aerial phenomenon was a major case. And while I mentioned that, I had gotten an email from Preston Dennett, the one that wrote the Schoolyard UFO Encounters, that since he came out with that book, he's gotten letters. Apparently, there's another case that happened around the same time as the aerial case, but it happened at an elementary school in Columbia, South America, that he's going to be investigating and checking into. So, but these are major cases. I'm trying to... Not that there's a pattern, but how often does this happen where, you know, we can expect that within some time we're going to see maybe something else major mass sighting is going to occur. But I'm just pulling all these records together and all these cases. That's why I found so many in North Carolina, that just going through it historically, going through newspapers. I go to the library a lot and just go through archives and just weed through newspapers, and occasionally up in Washington, you know, my old stomping grounds. But just putting together, trying to figure out how often and why. The school cases are, to me, fascinating alone, because it seems like that they've trying to get some kind of message across.
Yes,
you know,
I said that just 2 weeks ago, you know, or 3 weeks ago when Randy and Emily were on, that, you know, they're impressionable kids. They all, not all, but a lot of the encounters, there's some type of possibly telepathy or whatever. They have kids will talk about images of, you know, take care of the earth and all that, and you know, not exactly climate change, but something, you know, that there's pollution, there's whatever it is, you know, take better care of the earth. And I think that is kind of bizarre, but it makes total sense in a way.
Well, I just see, you see what's happening to this earth, and it's just not, you know, whether the arguments, whether it's man-made or not, it doesn't matter. I mean, just the pollution and everything we're doing itself, the damage we're doing with the nuclear waste.
No one ever talks about nuclear waste. I did a show on that when I was doing the Everything Else show. And basically, it's 5,000 generations before that stuff is safe. So we're putting the burden. I know this is way off the UFO topic, and someone probably wants to pull me off my soapbox. But we're putting the burden on 5,000 generations, 200,000 years into the future, that people have to be careful and have to guard that nuclear waste for our benefit.
I think this is the warnings that they're bringing down to these children. It's, you know, you can go all the way back to the Bible. You know, I mean, I don't want to get into religion or anything, but you've got the Ezekiel case that sounds more like a machine than anything. To me, I had a family friend that worked with my dad that wrote a book out of the angel's hand, where he took the Bible and he puts passages from that Bible. It's a fascinating book, but he did passages in that Bible and then wrote what as if these beings are coming down and this is the messages they're given.
Huh.
The way he, in his mind, he's pulling this through. These are the messages. These actual beings are coming down. They're not gods, but they're beings. They're trying to tell us how to live, how to eat, you know, how to take care of ourselves, how to take care of this planet. And it's a fascinating book. I'm sorry to say he passed away. He was one of the soldiers you see that was out west when they would set off an atomic bomb and then have them get out of the trenches and walk into the cloud. And he was one of those soldiers, and he ended up dying of bone cancer. And but he wrote this book. He came to one of our MUFON meetings. Never heard of Zachary Sitchin or any of his thoughts or anything, and just did this book on his own, just from his views. And it's called Out of the Angel's Hands. A fascinating book. But
wow, that is an interesting thought. I'm going to open up the line, so if anyone wants to call in, we have our screener, nice guy over there, Bill, will screen your call, and that number is 855-472-5483, and the phone lines are open if anyone wants to call in. So if we do get a call, I'll just let you know we have one waiting.
Okay.
And so... yeah, it's really fascinating, the all the different ideas. You know, I've said on this show a number of times, I really don't know any more about the UFO topic than I did when I started. You know, it's
that rabbit hole they talk about you go into. And luckily, I've been able to witness actual what I'll call craft. They're mm-hmm. not the glowing lights, you know, but
yeah.
they're some type of machine up in the air.
That's
amazing.
That's
flying really. Around.
Yeah.
Doing things that, you know, it's not everything they teach you in school, it's physics and everything. That's not possible. But,
then
having to come to the realization this exists, you know, it's true.
The sighting I had was actually what I would have to say, you know, would be none other than a craft, you know, but it was actually kind of a boring sighting compared to what you're talking about. It was just a simple disc flew over me, and it had a blue glow to it. And the thing that baffled me about the whole thing the most was the silence. I couldn't understand that, how
silence,
it could move
yeah.
and stop and, you know, do the things it was doing. It didn't do too much. You know, it just basically was going in a straight line, and it stops, and then it just went off to an angle toward Monterey. I was in Carmel Valley at the time, and I was in a hot tub, and it was kind of boring, but, you know, that was still a sighting.
It occurred.
And that's why I'm on the show today. Yeah.
Well, that's... Yeah. Another thing I've been touching in my notes and that I want to put in this book I'll eventually finish is I had by having that conference, I was able to, since I was paying them all to come and speak, to have a private meeting with Dr. Haynes and Xavier Passeau and Colonel Halt and Dr. Westrom. And I wanted to go over my life and my sightings and get their take on it and to find out, you know, it's just basically I want answers like anybody else, you know, but I just didn't understand why I had these sightings so much. And it's a private conversation. I was asked not to film it. I filmed it for myself, but Dr. Haynes, I found some revelations, some of the facts that he stated that I never knew about, but that I promised I wouldn't talk about. But Dr. Haynes and Dr. Westrom made me feel so much better about what I had seen. But the thing that fascinated me the most was I wondered that when I saw this and what I felt, and then discussing with Colonel Halt what he felt when he saw what he saw in Rendlesham, and how he's more at peace. He seems more at peace at what he saw than I am, you know, at peace at what I saw.
Wow. Hey, we have two callers on waiting now. So why don't we? Yeah, I had some really nice conversations in person with Charles Holt down there, and so I can't believe it's they're both from North Carolina, and we have Bobby, who I actually met Bobby at your conference. Bobby, welcome to the show.
Hey, how you doing, Martin?
I'm doing well. Thanks for calling. This is Kent is responsible for you and I hanging out together.
Yeah, I'm well aware. I met him and his beautiful family. It was a great experience for me. I mean, there was Charles Holt was there, the guy doing the Ariel movie. I got to speak to him for a while. He was there. What's his name again?
That's Randall
Nickerson.
Yeah.
Yeah, Randall. And, I mean, after the show on Saturday, I sat down and I got Timothy Good his first Corona with limes. We actually had to wait for the limes, so I had a great time.
Oh, yeah, I joined you in that. I thought Timothy was a real nice guy. Some of his theories are a little bit out there, but he's a nice guy. Smart, too.
Yeah, I've actually had a couple of his books. Yes, he is. I want to tell you, Mr. Center, I've actually had a lot of sightings. I moved here from Miami in 1995, and I'm in central North Carolina, a little town called Mebane. And
you're right down the street. I'm in Burlington.
Oh, okay. We need to get together. You can ask him for my name. One of the sightings I had a couple years ago, I was on the back deck, a daytime sighting with my daughter, and she said, "Dad, what's that?" I look up, and it was just a cylindrical craft. It was brilliant white, and it was heading south. It was heading east. It was at least 40,000 feet high or higher. And at that height, if I'm correct, it was larger than an airliner. It was completely silent. If it had been an airliner, I would have heard it because, I mean, it was large. I mean, holding your hand out, it was probably about the size of a dime or bigger. So it was large. And I know, I'm pretty sure it was a really high altitude. But that's just identical to the March sighting in 2018 of the two pilots over Arizona. One pilot asked the other pilot if he saw anything, and a white object flew over their two planes. Yeah, same exact thing. So,
wow. How about
interesting.
That?
Hey, Bobby. Thanks so much. We have another caller. Thanks for calling in. And it was a pleasure to meet you down there. And we've been actually in touch ever since. So I was really glad that happened.
I did want to tell him one more thing.
Oh, Go ahead. Sure. Yeah.
There's actually a video out of a hotel in Canada where a guy he worked at the hotel. He had a UFO, a close-up UFO event. And two men in black showed up to the hotel to look for him, but he wasn't there that day. But there's actually a security camera video of the front of the hotel, and these guys were tall, weird-looking, dressed just like Mr. Center described, black and very tall, and they were both identical. So you could actually find that video on YouTube. Thank you.
Like black suits? Yeah. All right, Bobby. Hey, take care. Talk soon.
That YouTube film, actually, I found that after the conference. I saw that online, and somebody had called me about it. And the funny thing was, that's kind of what they looked like. They were just, they had like, I don't know if you could tell it in that, but their skin was almost like a see-through, milky white. But they had the short guy that I said that did the talking is the spitting image of, in Nick Redfern's book, Men in Black, there's a picture that somebody took of this guy standing on the side of the street, leaning against the building. And I swear that's the same man that came in and did the talking to me. And that picture was taken so long ago.
Such a creepy thing. You know, there's so many people that are talking about having these experiences with these, it's hard to ignore. You can't ignore it. We have another caller calling from North Carolina again. We have Greg on the air. Greg, welcome to the show. You have a question for our guest?
Sure. Hi, Martin. Hi, Kent. How are you?
How you doing?
Good. Yeah, I had a question about the Men in Black situation. And I was wondering if you ever were able to determine if the police officers had any...
No, I still haven't gotten... I've actually made three attempts to get down there, speak with the public relations to see if I can get some help. And they always seem to be busy at the time. but I'm about ready to go back to my friend again and get some help from him to kind of maybe push that door open, because I've just, it seems like every time is just a waste of time going downtown and checking with them. I just keep getting blown off, but I really do want to finish that up.
How many years ago was that, Kent?
Well, that happened in 1993, is when the actual incident occurred. It was in 1993. Mm-hmm. It was in May, 93, at the end of May.
Okay. Greg, you have any other questions or comments?
No, that was it. I was just wondering about that, because it was a very compelling story about the Men in Black visitation. And, I've read several of them, and that one was very, very interesting.
Yeah, it scared me out. I tell you, I stopped investigating for probably about 4 or 5 years there.
Really?
It really shook me up pretty bad.
I can only imagine. Yeah, that certainly would be. But no, I appreciate the show. We watch it all the time, and great show tonight.
Thanks a lot. Thanks a lot. I appreciate the call.
Okay.
All right, we have lines are open. Again, anyone can call in. That's 855-472-5483. What were you saying, Kent?
That whole MIB thing was just, like I say, I actually stopped investigating for a while, and any time a case were to be called to me, I would just refer it down to somebody else. I was, one thing I forgot to mention is I sat in my chair. I felt like an electric shock in my stomach. It's like I was being some type of electrical force coming in my stomach, and I wasn't scared at the time. I was very curious, but I just felt it centered around my stomach. And I was talking to Randall about that, and he noticed when he was filming, they really harassed him. The helicopters flew over, and one jet flew over, but he was explaining that when the camo guys out there at Area 51, when they, as it gets towards dusk and everything, they'll back away, and then the military shows up. And whoever his connection was out there was telling him the distance you need to stay back to be safe. And from where he was filming, he said he still felt like he was being, something was hitting him and making him feel nauseated. And he had like an electrical tingling feeling. But
bizarre.
I've had Dr. Westrom asked me one time about being hypnotized to go through this, and I've always veered away from that. I've heard so much. I mean, there's a positive that comes out of it, but there's also all this negativity about it. It has to be the right person, to want to put things in your head and everything.
Yeah, you have to be real careful of that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've always been under the assumption I'm just going to let my mind, whatever comes out, the guy that was in training with me, I did call him to see if they showed up at his house or anything, but this was years after the fact. It's as if I just blacked out of that whole scenario, and didn't want to talk about it. And I remembered more and more as time came by on my own. So there's been a couple of other sightings I've had that I don't want to really go public with. It's yet that I will, but I'll probably write about it. But one involves being in the car, and next thing I know, I was on driving on the interstate, and next thing I know, I'm not even on the interstate. And having a sighting of this craft taking off is all I can remember. But one thing I do have is that when it first occurred, the glass blew out of my back window. My whole back window blew out.
Jeez.
And when you're driving on the interstate and when glass blows, it just got sucked all the way up to my dashboard. And I'm on the interstate driving late at night, and this glass came flying towards the front of my car.
That's so bizarre.
I heard this loud explosion, and I just closed my eyes and slowed down naturally. And when I did and opened my eyes and was brushing, just in case there was glass slivers around my eyes, and brushing away from my eyes. And when I did and opened my eyes, I wasn't even on the interstate. I was on a, it was basically a road out in the country about a mile and a half off the interstate. And the other funny thing was I had a dog that was in the very back of the car. And the dog was, then it was in the seat next to me laying down asleep.
Wow.
And it was just really strange, but that's what Dr. Westrum asked about being hypnotized, and I just don't want to do that yet, you know. Maybe later on if I get really sick, maybe I'll push the issue. But I just want my mind to
pardon me, go ahead.
Find out on its own. So
right. Dr. Westrum, I believe he's involved in the UFO data, which actually...
Possibly. I know he's getting up there in age. I hate to talk about people, but
yeah.
He's I think he was in his 80s when he came and spoke with us, but fascinating man.
Yes, he is. And real nice man, real nice gentleman.
Yeah, he came up and gave me a big hug after that little private meeting with Dr. Haynes, and
I may be thinking
told me I wasn't
wrong,
alone.
The wrong person. in particular, but also wanted to know, we do have, hopefully from UFO data, we have someone coming in for that show that's going to be hopefully on the 22nd of this month. And on that same show, we're going to have Dr. Seth Shostak from the SETI project. He's going to be on the same show in the latter part of it. Mm-hmm. We're not really going to be debating UFOs, but we're going to be talking about them. I want to hear what his thoughts are these days ever since Pentagon has, you know, admitted to checking UFOs out and all that. So we'll see what he has to say. He gets a little intimidated by, not intimidated. He's not a person you can intimidate, but he does not like to talk UFOs too much.
I learned from Dr. Haynes, how can it really affect those in their field by coming out on this subject? That was a sensitivity. As a matter of fact, a lot of people don't know. I have the conference DVD that I did. It's called the Scholars Collection, all the speakers. And they would not sign off on it if I put Timothy Good in there. So I had to run a separate DVD for Timothy Good in order to get there. I had some of these wanted to back down at the last minute. They were going to back down and not even come. And actually, Nancy Talbot saved the day because she's friends with Timothy Good. And
oh, Leslie,
said,
too.
You promised not to speak about aliens because their governments won't allow them to come. He said, no, I won't. And when I picked him up at the airport, first thing out of his mouth is, I'm going to talk about aliens. Watch this. And... oh, he did. So,
yeah, I can't remember his talk.
It cost me an extra $3,000 for production of another video. But
oh my God!
Towards the end there, when we do I actually give these DVDs away for the cost of whatever the postage to mail it to you. But anybody interested in this, my whole purpose was to get this out into the public. I've sent this off to schools. I've sent them to the universities.
Well, while you're on the subject, why don't you give out information how people can get a hold of you for that?
Yeah, it's I closed my website down, but I do have a Facebook page. It's the CUFORNC at gmail.com.
Say that one more time.
It's CUFORNC, like Q4 North Carolina, CUFORNC at gmail.com. If you send me an email and just want to mail me the postage on it, I will mail a copy of this at no charge out. It's a good group of speakers.
That I have never been more impressed by any speakers anywhere than I was with that conference. You know, I think of all the great.
I just wanted the truth to get out and be taken seriously. When I had the media come, I just wanted it not to be viewed with a taboo. It was always viewed. I wanted to see actual scientists. Leslie was so helpful. She's become such a good friend and helped me throw this group together.
Yeah.
And Timothy, he was one of the first conferences speakers that I went to speak. So he was the first one I asked to come. And after I did that, I found out it maybe wasn't such a good idea with the rest of them. But I was impressed. I went to the MUFON in Cherry Hill, New Jersey in 2014. Mm-hmm. And Stephen Bassett came up to me and was so upset. And he was like, how did you get them to come to your conference? Because he tried to get them to come to his, that big hearing thing he had up in Washington. And yeah. they wouldn't attend. And they came and spoke at mine. So he was a little upset about that. But whatever way the word has to get out, North Carolina, actually, we hosted the 1996 MUFON conference where Dr. Mack was one of the speakers there.
Oh, wow.
Luckily enough to get to meet him. And
yep.
Dr. Lear was there. And we had some good speakers back then. But North Carolina's got a good group. We used to have 150 people come to our meetings, every meeting.
My
and
goodness. That's unusual.
I think ever since... Yeah. I think they, ever since the whole John Venturi deal went down with MUFON and I personally, emailed Jan and asked Jan to please disassociate, for MUFON's sake. You can't have your national spokesman out there citing stuff like this. It's going to hurt MUFON. And, and Lakita Adams was our state director. And, It was sad because Lakita lost interest. We never had to pay for stuff like you do now with the brochures and stuff. When I started MUFON out, they would send us. We got a good group together, and we've stopped having the big meetings. We have about 30 of us get together, 40 of us get together, and every so few years I'll throw a conference on. And it draws a good gathering, but. I had as many in 2016 show up just about as I did this big conference I had in 2013. So there's a big following here in North Carolina, people interested in this subject. And I had just attended a class in January at Duke on UFOs by David Halperin, gave this class. So religion professor. But he's back with with Timothy Green and back in the early 50s and 60s with the Gray Barker and all that. So he's got a lot of history into UFOs. But
now is that,
my conference actually spurred Lakita went out to a couple of colleges and gave talks. I was asked to. I've given talks to five high schools. Classes. Wow. It really did a lot to push the issue out there and bring it to people's attention.
Wow. Now, we only have about 5 minutes left, just to let you know.
Okay.
So if anyone wants to call in, it's a last call for a call, and that number is 855-472-5483, or forever hold your peace. Now, getting back, someone was posting on the chat room that John Venturi is still very involved in MUFON. I thought I heard something about that, but I thought he was out. But
that's what pretty much has caused disbandment of. I mean, there's still a MUFON chapter, but it's not like it was. There's no really. We don't have a website anymore or anything. I don't belong to MUFON anymore. Lakita's backed out. It did its damage. And I hate it because I've worked so hard all these years, and you hear these stories, he's out, he's in, he's out. And, I hate to say, but I think it just comes down to a money thing, Just
someone else said that online. I read something about that, I don't know, maybe 6 months ago, that they thought it had to do money.
I can't, I'm not an accountant, I'm not in their books, so I can't make that accusation, but it's what I've heard, and it's going around, and I've heard of an outrageous salary that he makes monthly, Jan makes monthly, and it's just, for all the people that do hard work and good. There are so many good people in MUFON that work so hard and so diligently. And there's no science anymore. This is why I push everybody to Richard Hoffman. He's fantastic.
Right.
You know, and his scientific group. I mean, this is the way you're going to come about the discoveries, through science. And even our science probably couldn't keep up with whoever these are. but that's the only way that really, you know, can really solve this case, is to either come right out, the government's come right out, and or science itself, you know. And
do you really
that's
think
one
the
thing
government...
that impressed me about
No, go ahead.
I really don't think the government knows all that people think they know. I don't either.
Yeah.
And I'm fascinated. Like France and Chile, for instance, they have their own organizations that are paid for by the government that take this seriously, and they seriously will tell you these craft exist. They always have. And one of Jose's things was that with Sepha is that he wanted to make sure to try to get the United States to help them understand, you know, is this your craft, or are we looking at something that's coming from somewhere else? You know, they want the United States' help and be more open, and cannot believe, like, our pilots couldn't talk about it. And there's so many countries that do allow, you know, the exposure and for them to be free to talk about it. But it's like the Chicago Hare incident, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, if a tire blows up on a runway or a bolt falls off a plane as it's on takeoff, you know, they got to clean the runway. They got to file a report of FAA and everything. And here's this craft that wants to sit above the runway.
C-17, yeah.
Yeah, and there's nothing out of FAA. I mean, come on. Everybody can see now what the United States Navy is doing and announcing all this distrust they had with the government. They were right, you know. That this stuff has been hidden, and they're coming out little by little, more and more. You know, it's a good thing Tom's done about that, Louise. Not that they have all the answers or know everything, you know, and maybe this is a, you know, way to get some attention, but at least it's a start. At least it helped uncover this much so far.
That's, I don't think anyone can disagree with that. I really don't. But we are out of time. So if you could, once again, give out your Facebook page, if you could.
Yeah, that's CUFORNC@gmail.com.
That's how you find a Facebook page?
That's the website and my Gmail. And the Facebook page is Center for UFO Research, North Carolina.
Thanks so much,
Ken. It's on Facebook.
I can't believe the time went by so fast. Thanks so much. And you take care and stay healthy as you can.
Thank you so much, Martin, and God bless you. And keep it up. Keep up the good work.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
All right, everyone. That's it for the show. Next week, we have Kevin Day and Gary Voris coming on. And thanks so much for listening. We have to go. So keep your eyes to the sky, and we'll see you next week.